This is Making Conversation, the Australian Composers Podcast.
So A20 is about driving between New South Wales and South Australia. You know, I made that journey with fluorescent lights in the back of my car 4 times when I did Hatched Academy of Ensemble Offspring. And, you know, I remember going into the Masters Hardware in Wagga to buy more fluoros with my pink buzz cut. And it was just surreal because you realise the reality of these places when you go into the type of shops and the type of spaces that normal people actually do. And it's just so overwhelming to realise that there is so much in the world. There is so much. It is constantly full to the point that you have no idea where to even begin.
Where am I? Dan Thorpe leads me down a staircase into a dimly lit basement. We're in a little venue I've never been in before, on Adelaide's notorious Hindley Street. There are construction works just outside, and a weird electronic buzz is coming from over in the corner. I feel like I've stepped inside one of Dan Thorpe's compositions, a soundscape that's close and personal, yet also disconcertingly full of life's rough edges. What does it all mean?
So we're in the basement of a artist-run initiative in Adelaide called Format Systems. This is kind of, for me at least, a fairly iconic experimental arts and music venue in Adelaide and has hosted a lot of the shows and artists that have kind of hugely influenced me on a local level, but also like has hosted a lot of my shows and given me opportunities to perform. It's quite a little special little place for me, and there's a lamp attached, a floor lamp attached sideways to a wall,
yeah.
There's a piano, there's a PA and a massive sub, and an absolute ton of posters stretching all the way back through, like, a whole bunch of histories of Adelaide's underground music scenes sort of spread on all of the walls, and yes, this is my happy place.
You're listening to Making Conversation, the Australian Composers Podcast, and I'm David John Lang, but the voice you'll mostly be hearing is that of Dan Thorpe. As I discovered, it doesn't take too many questions to get Dan speaking passionately about music.
I kind of started composition with absolutely no idea about classical music whatsoever, absolutely none. I grew up in Adelaide's outer northern suburbs, which for those of you from interstate is not a nice part of Adelaide.
It's not a place I've been to very much myself.
Of course you haven't, David. David's a very nice young man. He wouldn't be seen past Jeb's Cross. I kind of grew up in the outer north, listening to a lot of punk, playing guitar, inexplicably playing piano at a very high level. Oh my god, it's so strange thinking back. I have no idea how.
How did that happen?
I have no idea. I couldn't tell you, honestly. But I just had a very good teacher who was very invested and very forceful about making me play classical music, and it turned out I loved it. So that was really good. But I had both my parents are totally tone deaf, no musicians, it's just me. When I first started going to gigs, it was punk gigs, and I kind of came into a composition course with that background. And, you know, actually probably one of the only things Graham Kern has said that's resonated with me was he spoke about when he went to Yale, he realised how behind he was, and he'd sit in the library and he'd listen to music and read through scores, and I said, fuck it, I'm doing that. And I did that for almost my entire composition degree, caught up on all this classical music. I had no idea whatsoever about almost anything from the 20th century or 21st century, let alone 21st century. I didn't even really know stuff from the 18th century. I kind of just had this weird, narrow pianist view of music. And I did. I kind of sat in that library and did things. But all while that was happening, I was going to a lot of punk gigs and I was going to a lot of other stuff. And when I started going to Format, I started realizing that there was kind of like a space between the punk stuff I was seeing and the stuff I was seeing in that university library. There was kind of this way of making art music that wasn't conservatory bound and wasn't bound to classical musicians, but that, you know, where I didn't have to feel weird about the fact that I was, like, poor, and I was this weird poor kid who didn't know who Stravinsky was, you know? Like, I didn't have to feel bad about that. And it kind of really broadened my mind, seeing a lot of these sort of bands and acts perform, really changed my practice in a really profound way.
I first got to know of Dan as a fellow composition student at Adelaide's Elder Conservatorium of Music, where he started his music degree a few years after me. And then, for a while, he disappeared. Turned out he was on an exchange in California.
I basically went to California because I didn't want to be in Adelaide. And it was an excellent experience. I went to University of California, Davis, mostly an agricultural college. Very good choice as a music student. Although that being said, the staff composers, which is why a big part of why I chose it, Pablo Ortiz, Sam Nichols, Ross Bauer, Laurie Sanmichael, like, you know, they're incredible composers, very much from a left field as well. And it was, like, it was huge for me to be away from Adelaide. I mean, I properly came out. That was a big thing. I, like, basically got to be a young adult. I basically got to be a young adult for a year. Got to, like, party and, like, learn to know myself and learn to know my music in that new environment. And when I came back to Adelaide, it also kind of got me back into this place of reconciling what I'd kind of done, what musically interested me my whole life, the punk and the experimental stuff and the, like, loud guitars and obnoxious basement shows, with what I was doing in the conservatory. And it was, yeah, formative, I believe is the term.
So on coming back to Adelaide, I mean, that was a while ago now.
Yeah, it was. It was 2012.
Yeah, And you're still here.
I am still here.
Well, this is something I'm interested in asking other Adelaide composers is, you know, so many people get up and leave. And, I mean, you do a lot of travelling.
I do a lot of travelling. You know, I think that there's, I mean, it's understandable, but it's bullshit, this thing that, like, just because there's not opportunities in Adelaide means that there's no culture, and I think that's wrong. I mean, I've heard this from a number of people kind of in non-classical scenes, you know, and a lot of my colleagues who don't operate in art circles. You know, like, the way the music scene functions here, the way that the art scene functions here, you know, none of us are getting paid. None of us are. Like, it's fucked. Like, it's ridiculous, and, like, it should change, but, like, the reality is none of us are getting paid, really. And that actually, on some level, is incredibly liberating, because you can take these enormous risks. Enormous in terms of conceptually. I mean, God knows, no resources to take risks with. But, you know, you can make work that's deeply exploratory and deeply experimental here, and there's all this space for it, because actually everyone who's here has the guts to take risks like that, because we don't have anything to lose. And I think there's an amazing culture about in Adelaide. I think that it's one that operates well and truly outside of the classical scene here, well and truly, but it exists and it's amazing. And, you know, like, it's weird because, you know, you did mention I travel a lot, and that's true. But to be honest, like, some of the best, especially electronic music, especially hardware electronic music I've seen, has been in Adelaide still. And some of the best experimental work has still, for me, been Adelaide-based. The vulnerability thing is honestly something that's come out of being queer for me, and I think we have this thing in our society where we fetishize coming out, where we're like, yes, you're gonna come out and it's all going to be okay. No, you actually come out every day, pretty much. Like, that's actually what the experience is. Like, you it's have to... It's an ongoing thing. You have to actually be like, I'm bisexual, I have a partner who's a man. Like, you know, like, it just happens a lot. But, you know, you do. You come out perpetually, and learning to do that and actually doing that is making yourself vulnerable in every sense of the word. Like, and my work has taken a lot from that. As soon as I kind of came to this realization, but what was interesting about my work was the fact that I made it. Wasn't this thing of like, oh, his harmonies are so... No, because no one actually thinks about music that way. I'm sorry. They just don't. Like, what's interesting about people's work is that they've made it.
That there's a person.
Yeah, because they're a person. you're like, you know, you want to hear what they have to say, and that's cool. But once I'd sort of worked out, I was like, okay, well, actually, all of this shit applies to my work as well. Like, you know, I have to be... My work has to be out. You know, my work has to be out. And my work has to be willing to be out and willing to be me. And that is a place of incredible vulnerability. And it's actually been incredibly cathartic on some level to be able to learn how to deal with that through my work. And that's become a lot of my work. Yeah, there's a lot of cliches about work as therapy, but to me, like, it's, you know, work is lived experience. Like, I make work that directly relates to my life and who I am and my experience of being alive. So I can learn a lot about how to be better at being alive from how I make work and how I present work and how I perform work. Yeah. You know, when we talk about this stuff, when we talk about... I hate the word accessibility, but when we talk about accessibility in contemporary music especially, for a lot of people, I think it becomes this really coded language of being like, no, the audience is dumb. And it's like, no, I make weird shit and weird, like, hardcore queer shit. And you know what? Actually, there's an audience for that because we want to hear things that challenge our perception of life, and we want to experience things that challenge us sometimes. And to me, that's my ideal audience, is an audience that wants to be challenged. Like, that's key to me. This is an argument about community. This is an argument about actually being involved in a community and making work that serves the community, and that's extremely important to me. It's like this thing of like, yeah, you get a job and you do the thing and you marry the girl in the house or the barn. No, but you know, like, it's...
The normal.
Yeah, you know, like, the normal, the quote-unquote normal yes. thing can be really taken for granted. And a lot of my kind of coming of age as an artist and queer person has been kind of unpacking stuff that I've... Unpacking the way I feel about stuff and the way stuff makes me feel that's not normal, and trying to, like, relate that back to who I am. And that means, yeah, like, I have read so much stuff by other queer people, so much queer theory, so much. But, like, also, I just read the news a ton and, like, read a lot of random stuff. And it kind of all comes out of that. Like, so much of my work comes out of the way... comes out of me coming to terms with how I feel about things. And, like, making work that, like, helps me through that, but also, like, reflects on that process. It's kind of almost like this... quasi-autobiographical, but also kind of like quasi-self-help book for other sad queer dudes coming to terms with what the fuck that is, you know? And I think that that's kind of my process in a lot of ways.
It sounds kind of messy, if I could put it that way.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know what? Life is so messy. Life is messy as hell, and like... You know, like, especially queer life is messy as hell. Like, you know, like, there's not really, like, a tidy way of going about being gay. I have a massive notebook. I basically, a big way I force myself to kind of write is I have hundreds and hundreds of pages of written notes. And by notes, I mean words. Like, I will sit and I will write out all of my thoughts on something. And then I'll go back and I'll edit. And I'll keep sort of going through that process. And then, yeah, like, in terms of actually making notes happen, it's, like, honestly something that causes me no end of anxiety. I had to change 6 bars in a piece. 6 bars. It took me 3 weeks to, like, build up the, like, emotional reserves to reopen the Sibelius file. Because, of course, when you work in, like, mixed graphic and traditional notation, oh, boy. Yeah, so then I had to transfer it to Photoshop. But you know what? It actually only ended up taking me about 2 hours in the end. It was literally getting to a point where I was like, I'm going to have to manually redo a page of all the parts. I'm going to have to redo a page of the score. I'm going to have to work out if these 6 bars even fit. I'm going to have to... And, like, you know, like, I do. I have serious angst. But the actual, like, the initial writing of that sort of piece was, like, a one-week job. It's hilarious. Like, you know, like, it's strange. Like, the initial kind of sketching out of how I wanted that piece to work and what I wanted it to do and how I wanted it to feel and be structured and what I wanted it to say took, like, less than a week. And it's, like, a 20-minute piece. In my head, I'm still this weird basement-dwelling, doll-wave, weirdo... I don't know. Like, I never made Doll Wave. That's a lie. But, you know, like, it's... In my head, that's kind of still who I am, and it's kind of strange, you know, after getting, like, a federal, like, grant and, like, touring and all this international stuff. It kind of still hasn't settled to me that I might actually be okay. I don't know. It still doesn't feel like... It feels kind of fake still. Kind of still feel like I'm faking it a little bit. Actually, most of my works have at least some graphic elements. Like, pretty much anything I wrote after late 2011 has a graphic or improv element. Something not many people know about me is I'm a very bad dancer as well. I've worked a lot with dancers, but I'm actually really invested in movement. full stop, as a means of, like, understanding my body better and feeling a connection with my body. In general, like, gesture is something that fascinates me. Like, the actual physical act of conveying something fascinates me. So I've done a lot of contact improvisation, and I've jammed quite a lot with contemporary friends. That's where a lot of my graphics come out of, is I have this actual physical sense of what I want the sound to do. So I convey the physicality of it by drawing it. And, you know, a lot of my stuff is hand-drawn. Some of it's digitally drawn. Actually, the more I graphic score, the more it becomes entirely hand-drawn, which is interesting, because it certainly didn't start that way. But I was a lot more insecure about my freehand skills. I've actually come to realize I'm actually okay at drawing stuff. So it's kind of, to me, it's a performance of a gesture. The actual graphic itself is a consequence of a performance of a gesture. And that's kind of what the musicians get. So that's how I make graphic work. Perform a lot of other people's work, and it's a big part of how I learn more about composition for a starter, because I'm just like, wow, I really liked what they did there. No, but also, like, you know, like, it is like curation and performance are such useful activities in terms of, like, actually getting your head around what you're interested in broadly. Because when you stop navel gazing, you know, just for a little bit, and identify what you like in other people's work, it says a lot about you. So I do, I perform a lot. I perform mostly work by women and queer composers. I feel really strongly that the best music being made in Australia right now is being made by women. No offense, David. I feel really strongly about this. I feel really positively about the way that actually things like Making Waves and people like Cat Hope and people like Vanessa Tomlinson and Claire Edwards and all these people have actually well and truly elevated this conversation to be something that's on everyone's mind. I'm really glad, or I hope it's on everyone's mind.
So you come across as a very extroverted person, Dan.
Really?
Yes. So I'm wondering, of course, the stereotype composer is someone who is an introvert and spends a lot of time by themselves. I don't ever see that side of you, but is that there?
I force myself to be like this, so yes. It's really funny because people say this to me all the time, and like, you're such an extrovert. I spend like a solid 6 to 8 hours a day alone. When I'm out and engaging with stuff, engaging with art, and kind of talking with people about art, I come across as incredibly extroverted, but it is something that I have to make myself do. But it's something that comes from feeling passionately about art and feeling passionately, not just about what I do, but about what my peers do. And, you know, all the people who've kind of met me at shows and exhibitions and stuff do tend to think of me as this big character. But, yeah, I mean, the reality is that I spend so much time alone. And it's so important to me. It's so important to me to have silence in my day and to have stillness in my day. That was a tangent.
That's fine. I didn't know where we would go with that, but... Wow, it keeps getting so philosophical.
But it has to! It has to! Why the fuck do we make work if we don't have anything to say? I'm sorry, but like...
I know
you're not complaining, but like, to me, it's this thing of like, of course it fucking gets philosophical. How could it fucking not? How could you have nothing important to say in your work? I cannot reconcile why you would make art if you didn't feel like there was something important that needed to be said. Maybe it doesn't have to be important, but I think work should at least say something. At least. Anything, really. I don't know. I feel very strongly about that. And yeah. that's what I program, that's what I see.
Yep.
And it's, I think, probably why I go to more theatre than orchestra concerts. That's a good laugh.
That is the laugh of Dan Thorpe, and this is the end. Throughout this episode, we've been listening to Dan performing his own composition, A20, recorded by Sebastian Tomczak. You can find the full performance, along with video, on YouTube. You can also find out more about Dan and what he's up to at his website, www.danthorpe.net. Finally, I'd like to end by thanking Dan for sharing so openly and so passionately about how, and more importantly, why, he makes music.
The Making Conversation podcast is brought to you by Making Waves. Making Waves is a free online listening resource bringing listeners the latest new music from Australian composers. We'd love for you to discover, listen, like, subscribe, and share new Australian music. You can find us at makingwavesnewmusic.com. We'd like to thank all the people who made this season possible. This includes the supporters of our crowdfunding campaign, project patron Cameron Lamb of Camaclan, and Creative Partnerships Australia's match funding program. The series production team is Leah Blankendahl, Stephanie Eslake, Sasha Kelly, David John Lang, Matthew Lorenzen, Rebecca Aaron-Smith, Chris Williams, Antonia Zappia, Daniel Thorpe, Thomas Green, Lisa Cheney and Peggy Polias, along with interns Angus Baxter, Malena Radice and Mark Wolfe. The podcast theme music was the work I/O by Australian composer Elias Simic Prozic. If you wish to learn more about the composer, music or interviewer featured in this episode, head to our website and click podcast to view the show notes. If you're enjoying these podcasts from Making Waves, there are a number of ways in which you can show your support. You can subscribe to the podcast via iTunes or your favourite app. You might even like to leave a review. You can also share this episode and the series with your networks. Making Waves is a voluntary endeavour. If you're interested in volunteering or interning with us, we'd love to hear from you. We also encourage you to consider making a small one-off or continuing donation to support the ongoing promotion of new Australian music and composers. Visit makingwavesnewmusic.com/support.